Not really yet. Good noon, almost. Welcome to the first cosmology lecture. So the whole course will be rather introductory. So I'll do simple stuff, and then if you are interested in more complicated things, then please attend the cosmology explorations by Kendrick. Although that course will be probably a little bit more observationally oriented than this one. So this one is pure theory, basically. The first question, why you may ask, you know, why to study cosmology? And I'll give you at least four reasons why that. So why cosmology? The first reason is that it combines very interesting and rich physics. So as we will see, we will need to, you know, to describe our universe, we will need lots of theories combined together. So we will need statistical physics, we will need thermodynamics, we will need general relativity, we will need particle physics. Cosmology actually provides very interesting ground for testing fundamental theories like quantum gravity or string theory. So maybe there are some predictions by these theories which can be tested in cosmology. So let me just make a quote by this famous physicist. Now we have some kind of chair or some kind of fellowship at PI as well. So Zeldovich was this famous Russian physicist. And so he said that the early universe is an accelerator for poor. An accelerator for poor. And so indeed, you know, there's very many high energetic processes which you can see. There's cosmic rays coming to you all the time. There's things which happen close to the Big Bang and so on. So really, if you want to study particle physics now, actually most of the particle physicists at this point actually are cosmologists as well. They use this as their experimental ground for this. So this is now actually very, very relevant here. It's also an open arena for testing fundamental theories like string theory or quantum gravity or other things. Okay, so that's the first reason. So it's very, very nice, very, very interesting, very, very rich physics. Second reason is actually it's not really a fairy tale at this point. It's lots of observations, which actually tell you, yeah, I can really, you know, limit my theories. I can test my theories. If the theory is not giving you what you see, then you know that the theory is wrong, actually. So it is observation-based. And actually, this is not so trivial as it might seem, because that's true maybe the last 20 years or something like that. But before, the data are not really accurate, and you could fit all the theories you wanted. But now you have really, really, you know, severe restrictions of what you know for sure has happened in the early universe. And then, of course, the theory has to correspond to that. So the origins of the cosmology were basically based on this cosmological principle, like I am not special in the universe, and I assume that on large scale it's homogeneous and isotropic and stuff like that. That was like assumptions, if you want, which go back to the Middle Ages where people said, well, I'm not special, I'm actually not at the center of the solar system, and so on. This is not true anymore. Now you have really very solid observations which actually tell you that this is indeed true. Okay. So now, of course, everybody expects that maybe some new observations will come with gravitational waves. So you know, gravitational waves provide a new window to the universe, and maybe they'll give us some extra data. Okay. So now this is good. Now if you want to do PhD or something like that, then this is very important for you. So new physics likely to be discovered here And so why this is the case is that there is many, and we will talk about it during the course, but there is many problems and there is many puzzles which actually emerge, and they lurk at you everywhere. So let me mention some of them. So for example, of course, the most famous is the lambda problem. So what is lambda? Why do we have dark energy in our universe? What it is, and so on. We will see an eta problem. So eta is a fraction which measures how many photons with respect to how many baryons you observe. And of course, it's assumed, or it's the theory is that the ratio comes from the fact that we had matter at the origin, and we had antimatter, and this annihilated together. But if we had exactly the same amount of matter and the same amount of antimatter, then they would annihilate and nothing would be left, just photons. But this is not true. There was actually more matter at the beginning. And that's why we still have some baryons left. And that's why we have lots of photons. So where this number, which is the fraction of the baryons and photons, come from, why is it so small, and so on. So there's another problem which we'll see. We'll see a lithium problem. So you will have a nice theory which predicts how much helium actually was fused in the Big Bang from the hydrogen. And if you apply the same theory to lithium, you get a prediction, and this is not what is observed. And actually, it's you know, like four times different than what is observed. So the question is the theory wrong, or what's actually going on? Why do we have lithium, which is not really what is predicted by the theory? Of course, nowadays, lots of problems. So all the problems is all problems with inflation. Many of them, we'll talk about it last week and so on. So there's, you know, lots of problems, lots of things which actually demand a new theory to be formulated.
You said all problems are solved or linked with inflation?
No. I'm saying that inflation has many problems. Yeah. Okay. And so maybe the most interesting for you is that contrary to theoretical gravitational physics, actually, if you study cosmology, you are much more likely to get a job, right? Because there is many more positions in cosmology than there is in gravitational physics, for example. And yeah, of course, it's rich physics, it's nice physics, it's related to experiment. So that's why it actually makes sense, right? Okay, so this is why cosmology. Are there any questions? So now let me mention a few facts which we know for sure, and we will of course make this much more accurate later on. So established facts. And we will add many more to this, but this is just very, very rough summary. So first of all, we observe that at large scales, the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. And of course, this has to be true in large scales, not in small scales, because definitely if you measure the density here where I stand and the density here where the air is, they will be different. But on average and in large scales, the density is somewhere like everywhere the same and in every direction the same. Okay, the universe is expanding. And this is very well described according to Hubble's law. Okay, so that's another fact. So we have basically homogeneous and isotropic universe, which actually is expanding in time, getting bigger. Then we observe that it is filled with the cosmic microwave background, so with the radiation, with photons, which are very, very cool photons. They have temperature 2.73 Kelvin at this point. So the whole universe is filled with this radiation. We also observe baryonic matter, And the basic observation here is that basically everything is hydrogen. So 75% of the matter in the universe is actually hydrogen. 25% is helium. And of course, everything else is just teeny tiny seasoning above these things. So that's another observation. Then if you have just the standard general relativistic model of cosmology, then you also have to add dark matter and dark energy. And so they would form 95% of matter. So actually, this thing is only 4%, something like that. And so everything is hiding in this dark matter and dark energy. And of course, nobody knows what they are. Okay. Very good. And so finally, we have some small fluctuations. So in average, we have this homogeneous and isotropic universe. But we have also small fluctuations, which don't really have to be small. But what I mean by fluctuations, for example, you have also galaxies, which are sort of fluctuations, right? So they are definitely denser than the rest of the universe, and stuff like that. So small fluctuations, we could have galaxies. But also, we have fluctuations in the CMB. And so the CMB actually has this average temperature, which is approximately 3 Kelvin. But there's fluctuations of this temperature as you look at different directions in the sky. And the fluctuations are of the order 10 to minus 5. If I have delta T versus this T, then it's actually 10 to minus 5. So CMB fluctuations in temperature, and they are of the order 10 to minus 5. So really teeny tiny fluctuations. Of course, as we will learn, that basically the CMB describes how the universe looked like a long time ago. And so it described the original fluctuations in matter density and stuff like that in the universe. And then as the universe expanded, then what you assume that the regions which were a little bit more dense at the origin, actually that's the seed for the galaxy or something like that, the regions which were basically empty, that's the seeds of voids and stuff like that. So actually, you can see these teeny tiny fluctuations describe how the universe was not homogeneous very, very long time ago. And then, you know, by the structure formation, the denser regions gave rise to galaxies and stuff like that. Okay, so now this is basically the plan what we are going to do. So this is about the homogeneous universe, and which we will discuss the first week. This is about the matter. Which we will basically discuss second week. And then we will talk about fluctuations in the third week. So. And that's the plan. So now if you look at the handouts I gave you, so that's, you have more detailed course menu there. But also you have some additional reading. So first of all, maybe you noticed that there is some study text on the wiki. So I'll basically follow that study text. But there's also an excellent book by Donaldson, Modern Cosmology, we will use for some parts of the course. I quite like Muganov's Physical Foundations of Cosmology. So that's a very nice book. Again, we will use some parts of it in the course. But surprisingly, already Carol's book, actually Introduction to General Relativity, has some chapters on cosmology. And it's actually a very, very nice, you know, nice selection of topics. So that's, again, it will be very helpful for this course. That's one. Also, if you don't like listening to me, you can listen to Leighton Boyle's lectures several years ago, or you can actually read Baumann's lectures from Cambridge. Okay, so there you go. Are there questions to the plan? Okay, no questions. So then we will have three topics, three chapters. So chapter one there'll be homogeneous universe. So just to make an approximately what we are talking about, so the observable universe, how far we can see, so observable universe is quite big, and it's something like 3 × 10⁴ megaparsecs. Of course, the parsec is the standard unit used in astrophysics or cosmology. So parsec is 3.26 light years, and that's a lot of kilometers. So 10 to the 12 kilometers or 10 to the 13 kilometers is one parsec. And so now we have 3,000 megaparsecs. That's how big the universe at this point is. So now I told you that basically it is homogeneous and isotropic. That's true for the scales which are sufficiently large. So homogeneous and isotropic in scales which are something like 100 megaparsec. So if you average over all galaxies, over all groups of galaxies, all voids and everything, then the universe will look the same at these scales. Okay. Of course, you know, this 10 to the minus 5 fluctuations in CMB, that's really telling you that it's homogeneous and isotropic on these, originally on these, much, much, much more accurate than for the galaxies and stuff like that. Okay. So now, one important thing is that you always say it's homogeneous and isotropic. So isotropic means that if I look in all the directions, it looks the same. Homogeneous means if I stand here, observe the universe around me, and then I move to some other place and observe the universe around me, I see the same thing. Of course, there's no observational data for that. Okay, we never were able to travel to Alpha Centauri and observe the universe from Alpha Centauri to actually see that it looks the same there. Okay, so isotropy, we can observe. We observe. So we can really easily look at all the directions in the sky from one point. But for the homogeneity, actually, this is not so simple, and we don't have any evidence for that. So here actually comes this cosmological principle, or so Copernicus cosmological principle, well, which tells you, well, we are not really special in the universe, right? So despite what your mother told you, we are not at the center of the universe. We don't have a privileged space there, a privileged role in the universe. And so what it means is that whatever we observe, everybody else who is, you know, standing there has to observe. Okay, so then we have homogeneity. Well, okay, so then everybody, every observer in universe sees the same. In other words, we have isotropy at every point in the universe. So no matter where the observer is sitting in the universe, they see the isotropic universe. So now there's a beautiful mathematical theorem saying, well, if I have a space where every point in that space is actually isotropic, then it's actually homogeneous as well. Okay, so the homogeneity comes from this principle, basically. So from here, theorem, we have homogeneity as well. So this is just a subtle point, but yeah. Isotropy is obvious. Homogeneity is basically, you need an extra assumption for this, because we haven't seen, we cannot see homogeneity. We are just sitting in one place. Okay, so anyway, so to the first extent, in the first homework, in the first week, you will just see, we will just assume that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Okay. So, other questions? No question. So, part A, yes?
Sorry, so I don't see, can we just make a map of the universe and then like imagine what it would be like to stand in another galaxy and see that it would be isotropic?
Maybe you could do something like that, I think, but I'm not sure. I don't know.
We have a bunch of data.
You have a bunch of data, that's true. But I...
You can't see. Yeah, we can't see their observable universe.
Huh?
We can't see their observable universe, I guess.
That's right, yeah. But you know, if you just stick to the observable universe, maybe. Interesting. Okay, so part A, maximally symmetric spaces. So why do we not need to talk about maximally symmetric spaces? Is basically they describe all homogeneous and isotropic universes. Okay, so we want to describe all homogeneous and isotropic spaces. And so we will do it in one go, not really. And so there's a beautiful construction of all these. And that comes that all these spaces can be embedded. So if you consider n-dimensional isotropic and homogeneous space, it can be embedded in n plus one dimensions. Okay, so construction is through the embedding. In n plus one dimensional space. So Ruth already mentioned this in her gravitational course, but let me do it once more. So of course, the first example is very simple. So let's consider a sphere. Okay. So I have x1, x2, x3, now this is my sphere, which has radius rho. And so the space which you want to embed this is, of course, nothing else than the Euclidean space in three dimensions. So the metric, so Euclidean space. The metric in that Euclidean space is just dx1 square plus dx2 square plus dx3 square. So that's the space I am embedding the thing. And of course, the equation of embedding is that if you sum over x1 plus x2 plus x3 square, you get rho square. So this is my embedding. Is rho square equals to x1 square, x2 square, plus x3 square. Well, this is way too trivial. But to get really the metric on the sphere, you just differentiate this equation. So you get 0 is x1 dx1 plus x2 dx2 plus x3 dx3. So I'm embedding, I'm differentiating my constraint. And then I solve this for, let's say, dx3. So dx3 is x1 dx1 plus x2 dx2. Okay, I want dx3 square. So square divided by x3 square. But that's rho square minus x1 square minus x2 square. Okay? So just taking this. And of course, you just plug it here. And that's your metric on the sphere. Okay, so that was a very, very simple example. You can also change coordinates to spherical coordinates, and then it will be much nicer. you just introduce the spherical coordinates as you know them, you just get the standard metric on the sphere, d theta square plus sine square theta, d phi square times rho square. Okay? So that's the simple example. Now let me do equally simple example. Example two, which will be hyperboloid, but it will not be hyperboloid in Euclidean space as you know it, but it will be a hyperboloid in Minkowski space. Okay, for some stupid reason, we decide to embed it in Minkowski rather than in Euclidean space. And the reason why we do that is precisely that this hyperboloid actually appears in our universe, only one dimension higher. Okay, so example two will be hyperboloid. And so what I really want to describe is, okay, this is my light cone in the Minkowski space. This is my x3, which is something like time. And then I have x1 and x2. Then what I really want to describe is this thing here. And then there's a corresponding hyperboloid here. Okay. So it's a two-sheet hyperboloid embedded in Minkowski space. Okay. So how you describe these things is that basically you take the same thing here, you decide for the embedding space. Now it won't be Euclidean, it will be Minkowski. And then you decide for the embedding equation. And everything can just be achieved by shuffling some signs. So here we had all signs positives everywhere. So now we will have some signs negative. So Minkowski is just d squared is equal to dx1 square plus dx2 square minus dx3 square. So there's this minus here telling you that you are in Minkowski space. And then the embedding here will be, now you put again rho square. And then you put x1 square, and then x2 square. And that would be good. So let's put minus x3 square. And let's put also minus here. So now we just shuffled some signs. We have one minus here with respect to the sphere. And then we have one minus here with respect to the sphere. And then we are embedding in Minkowski space rather than Euclidean space. OK? And so if you do this, you get exactly that picture over there. It's a two-sheet hyperboloid. Here, again, I can differentiate this equation, solve for dx3, plug it here, and I get a metric on this two-sheet hyperboloid. So now, really, this is basically a lower dimensional picture of what we think the universe is. Could be. So it will be just one part. Of course, this is a two-sheet hyperboloid, so you have to throw away one of them. But this thing could be a hyperbolic space of our universe if you lift it to one higher dimension. Okay, so this is the hyperboloid here. So of course you see that the induced metric on this thing here, because we are within the light cone, it's actually Euclidean. So this is really could be a space for our thing. Okay, so that was another example. Is this clear, these examples? Very good. So now let's do the general thing. So general, and of course, everything will be equally complicated if you introduce some nice notation. So first, you say, well, say there's some signature P and Q. So what I mean by that is that I will have a metric eta AB P and Q, which is a diagonal metric. It's like Minkowski metric, but it has P times P pluses. So it's diagonal, it's plus, 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 and then it's minus, minus. And there's P times plus, and there's Q times minus. Okay, so this is my metric which I'll be using here. So it's like Minkowski metric, but now with signature PQ. Okay, then I'll be talking about I'll be embedding in the space which has coordinates xa. And so these a coordinates go 1 to n plus 1. So this is my embedding space coordinates, xa. And then I'll have coordinates with small index a, which go from 1 to the n. And these are basically the coordinates on that surface. Okay, I'll also lower the index, and I'll lower the index with this Minkowski metric here. So xa is index down, is just eta ab eq of xb. Okay. And then you can also write x squared, which is xa, xa. So it's just the notation. So with this notation, everything now will be very simple. Okay. So now the statement is that if you want a n-dimensional maximally symmetric geometry, with of signature P and Q and curvature K, which can be either 0, plus 1, or minus 1. So I have three possibly discrete values for K curvature. It's 0, plus 1, or minus 1. And so this is given by, so first you have to decide which space to embed in. So so the space we are embedding in is ds square, which is eta ab b and q dxa dxb plus k times dx n plus 1 square. Okay, so this is my embedding space. So now you see basically like the sphere or the hyperboloid. I have the freedom to shuffle some signs here, or of course if k is equal to 0, this is just the Minkowski space. But also I have the signs possibility of changing signs here, eta ab. Okay, so let me call this eta ab of p q and k dx a dx b. So now I'm defining this new metric eta ab with this capital indices, which includes that dxn as well. Okay, so that's the space I'm embedding in. And the constraint will be eta ab p q and k xa xb equals to k rho square. Okay, so that's the embedding equation. Again, I have the freedom to put here. So now, of course, this is non-trivial only if k is not equal to 0. So if k is equal to 0, I just have flat space of arbitrary signature. This is more interesting if k is plus 1 or minus 1. Then I have this nice embedding here. OK, so this is all, if you want, these two equations describe all maximally symmetric spaces there are to be described. OK, so now we proceed exactly the same way as we did for the sphere. So OK, I have to differentiate the second equation. And then let's say, solve it for dx n plus 1 square, plug it into the first one. Okay. So the only problem is that k is plus minus 1, so I have to actually make sure that I'm doing the right thing with k plus minus 1 or 0. So now I don't need to do it, right? You can do it yourself. Okay, let me do it. So we have k rho square is k x n plus 1 square plus x square using my notation. So that's my constraint. If I differentiate that, I get k x n plus 1 times d x n plus 1 equals to minus x a dx a. Okay, so I differentiate that. So now I have to solve for this one, dx n plus 1 square is x a dx a square divided by x n plus 1 square, and then you have to make sure that the k's are right. So if you make sure that the k's are right, then you find that this is rho square minus k x square. So the k actually propagates into this thing here. Okay, just do it for k plus 1 minus 1. So now we have this thing here, and we plug it back. And so what we are finding is that the metric on that space, taking into account this constraint, so plugging it over here, so we get that the metric GAB P, Q, and K is given, of course, by the flat metric eta AB PQ. And then we have plus k times dx n plus 1 square. So plus k. And then dx n plus 1 square is here. So xa k xa xb rho square minus k x square if you tear apart the basis dxa dxb. Okay, so this is the metric on any maximally symmetric space, if you want. And it's that simple through this embedding construction. Okay. So now, why do we call them maximally symmetric? So first of all, you can calculate, and I hope it's not your homework, because it's, maybe it is, we'll see. So you can calculate the Riemann tensor out of this. Of course, you use the standard machinery for GR, you calculate Christoffel symbols, you make a Riemann tensor, and so on. So the Riemann tensor, R, A, B, C, D, and if you do it, it's extremely simple. Result is just K over rho square. And then the symmetries are just captured by GG. So GAC, GBD, and then GAD, and GBC. Okay, so this is the Riemann tensor corresponding to this metric. And so people actually, you know, doing GR, whenever they find that Riemann is given by this metric times metric minus metric times something, and they call this is a maximally symmetric space. Of course, I'm not telling you why maximally symmetric, right? I'm just giving you a construction through this embedding. I'm giving you the metric, so you will have to discuss why maximally symmetric. But before we do that, it's easy to construct this and calculate the Ricci tensor and calculate the Einstein tensor. So now, this is a solution of Einstein equations so if you write them as g mu nu plus lambda g mu nu, this is a different convention than Drew's had. She had minus there, I prefer plus 8 pi t mu nu. Also, I will not be carrying out G Newton, I'm just setting equal to 1, contrary to what Roos did. So now these are my Einstein equations. So these metrics will be a solution of Einstein equations, provided that there is no matter. So T mu is equal to 0, and that the cosmological constant is given by k times n minus 1, n minus 2, divided by rho square, 2 rho square. Okay, so this radius rho is somehow related to the cosmological constant as 1 over rho square. So these metrics are solutions of Einstein equations. Okay, so this is great. So finally, let's discuss some special cases of these things. So we have already seen a sphere, and we have seen this two-sheet hyperboloid. But perhaps for physics, more interesting is actually, of course, Minkowski space is a special case. But also, De Sitter space is a maximally symmetric space, or anti-De Sitter space, which you have seen in Roos' course. So we can draw a table depending on what p, q, and k are to see what possibilities we have. So we have a table. Where in the first row we put the signature p and q, and then we put k equal to 0 and k equal to plus 1 and k equal to minus 1. Okay. So we can start with the Euclidean space. So P is n and Q is 0. So this is, I'm embedding in the Euclidean space. So of course, if K equals to 0, then we just have Euclidean space. Right? So that metric GAB is just Euclidean. So this is just Euclidean space. Flat space in n dimensions in Riemann signature. If you have k equal to plus 1, we have seen that example, but now we are in n dimensions, so we don't have S2, but we have Sn. And we've also seen the example of H2, but here you would have Hn in n dimensions. These three are very, very important for our universe because they can describe the spatial slice of the universe, which is consistent with homogeneity and anisotropy. However, to have fun and to have unifying picture, we can also consider signature n minus 1 and 1. So now we are embedding in Minkowski space. So if k equals to 0, we just get that Minkowski space in n dimensions, Mn. If k equals to plus 1, then you get De Sitter in n dimensions. If k equals to minus 1, you get anti-De Sitter in n dimensions. OK. So as a true mathematician, let us continue. We can put n minus 2 and 2. So now we are embedding in space, which has two time directions. Of course, you can do it, and mathematicians would do it. But typically, two time directions are bad because of problems of some time, closed time-like curves and stuff like that. So you can actually go into the past and kill your grandfather and whatever. You wouldn't be born. So actually, these spaces which have more times are typically unphysical. So for physicists, this is actually the end of the story. But if you are a mathematician and you want to classify all these spaces, yeah, you can continue and put many time things if you want. So anyway, so for physics, these are really, really important six spaces which are described by this construction. And OK. So now let me make a picture of what De Sitter space is. So I'll do it in three dimensions. So I'll describe my deciter as two-dimensional hypersurface. So DS2 will describe. And so you have your coordinates x1, x2, and x3. But you know that you are embedding in the Minkowski space. So x3 is actually time. I'm not, right? Interesting. So maybe my picture is wrong. I'll just plot whatever I have here. I have x2 as time. Sorry for that. x3. So now you have the light cone. And then whatever is actually outside of the light cone is your hyperboloid in Minkowski space, and this is how the deciter space looks like. Okay, so that sheet is your deciter space. It has positive curvature because it lies outside of the light cone. It's actually a Minkowski metric on it. So this is something which describes early and late cosmology, as we will see. Very, very important cosmological space. So now if you want anti-deciter, then you just take it and put it on its side. Okay? So for ADS, you do the same construction. So now I have x2 is time, x1 as before. But not now also x3 is time. And then you are outside of the light cone. And you are just putting everything on its side. This is my thing. And this is how anti-deciter looks like. Okay. Now you immediately see a problem here. So I am embedding in Minkowski space, but also I have this k equal to minus 1. So that's why I actually have two times, right? So if you look at the construction over there, I have two times. So one time is over here. Another time is over here. So now if you circle around here, for example, you keep x equal to constant, and you circle around here. Precisely, you are moving only in time directions. So you have actually time-like closed curves. And that's why anti-deciter is actually a little bit problematic. So you have closed time-like curves. So if I fix my x1, which is spatial, and then go only in x2 and x3 directions, and I'm actually moving time only. Okay, so that's quite bad. And so what people do is that they say, well, either I can live with these closed time-like curves, so if I travel future in time, actually come back from here, or we go to a covering space, meaning that they say, well, as I travel over here, and I come to the same point. Actually, I didn't come to the same point, but there is another sheet of this hyperboloid, and I go sort of on that another sheet. There's another sheet, and I go on that other sheet, and I go another sheet, another sheet. So actually, I'm still going forward in time. I'm not actually circling around, and so this is called covering space. So sometimes go to covering space. And then you don't have closed time-like curves. But there are some other problems with the covering space. So anti-deciter space, as you see it, although string theorists love it very much, it's already problematic from these pictures. Okay? But deciter space is something really nice, and we will make good use of it in cosmology. Questions? Yeah?
If I don't have any intuition about the k equal plus 1 and minus 1, in more details, like If you see one of those, how can you know, oh yeah, k is equal to plus 1 or k is equal to minus 1?
If you see one of those? OK, so, so for example, here, I didn't really stress it, but OK, so I have this 8ab xa is xb equals to k times rho square. So rho square is always positive. So this k, if you want, determines the sign setting in front of rho square. So if you have plus rho square here, it will correspond to positive positive curvature. For example, for the sphere, you know that rho is sort of the curvature is inside. However, if you look at the hyperboloid over there, then you see that I've been putting minus rho square. So actually, that corresponds to a negative curvature. So if you want, this k sort of describes what type of curvature I have. So in this hyperboloid, of course, rho square will be going from here to there. That's a positive number. But this thing here has a negative curvature. So if you want, this k describes what type of curvature you have.
OK, so my question is, how can we read the curvature if we see a picture? Like in those pictures, can I read the curvature?
So for example, you can consider geodesics. I set two geodesics away from each other. Mm-hmm. If I have positive curvature, they will eventually come back and they will intersect again. If I have negative curvature, they will just go diverge apart. Mm-hmm. Or if you look at triangles, the same thing, right? If I am in flat space, I have just 180 degrees here. I can have something like this, or I can have something like that, right? So I can measure how many degrees I have in the triangle, and then I determine which space I have. So this would be negative. This would be positive. So you can locally tell what type of curvature you have. OK, so these are the examples. But why the hell maximally symmetric? I still haven't explained that. OK, so you know that the symmetries in GR correspond to Killing vectors. So more Killing vectors I have, more symmetries I have. So these spaces better have the maximal number of symmetries there can be. So the maximal number of Killing vectors. So now anybody can tell me how many Killing vectors are there at most, let's say in four dimensions. Anybody?
10.
Very good, 10. How many in five dimensions?
N times n plus 1 over 2 or something like that.
Sorry?
N plus 1 times n over 2 or something like that. The number of
symmetries. Yeah, it's n over 2, yeah, plus n. So, OK. So very good. So let me now show you why is this the case and what's going on. So why maximally symmetric? So we know that the symmetries correspond to Killing vectors. And the Killing vectors are just described by equation double I psi b plus double b ci psi a equals plus 0. So this is my Killing equation. And I say that the space is symmetric, there is a Killing vector, if I can actually find a solution of this equation. So now, not every spacetime admits a solution of this equation. And so the spacetimes which do have Killing vectors are special. Okay. So now, how do I find whether the spacetime admits a Killing vector or not? Okay. Try to solve this equation. It's always an impossible task. Okay. So people cannot really, unless they see it immediately from the metric, to solve this equation typically very complicated. OK, so what they do is that they ask a mathematician for help, integrability. And a mathematician tells you, well, let's study some integrability conditions for this. OK, So typically, integrability condition is something like I see an equation, I differentiate it once more, I commute the derivatives if I can, and I see what the result is, and whatever. So you can do that. So you can actually differentiate this equation once more with respect to nabla c, and then play with commuting the derivatives. Of course, by commuting the derivatives, I pick up a Riemann tensor. Okay. So now this is a trivial exercise which you'll do in your tutorial. But what you actually find out is the corresponding integrability condition. So I get nabla a, nabla b, xi c. And it's given by this Riemann tensor. And then it will be b, and then nu, what the hell is that? Nu is c. And then A and D, psi D, maybe. Okay, so this is your integrability condition. So if I differentiate my Killing vector twice, then I get something which depends on the Riemann tensor and the Killing vector itself. Okay, so now this integrability condition has many useful and nice applications immediately. So let me mention first one, which actually, so if you remember and you have taken the gravitational physics course, then at one point I told you, well, let's use the Killing vector, and let's say this is like a potential for electromagnetic field in Schwarzschild spacetime. I told you, let's take dt, and you found that actually this dt Killing vector satisfies Maxwell equations. Okay, there. So let's look at this. So if I contract the index a and b here, then I get nabla square acting on xi c. And then if I contract the index a and b here, I get the Ricci tensor. So it's equal to or plus the Ricci tensor c d xi d equals to 0. So this is my equation, which is satisfied for sure out of this integrability condition. Okay. So now, in vacuum, of course, my Ricci tensor equals to 0. And so you have an equation, nabla square psi c equals to 0. So actually, the Killing vector satisfies the wave equation. However, looking at this guy, if I contract the indices a and b here, well, then this term is the same as that term. And I find the divergence of xi is equal to 0. Divergence of xi equals to 0 as well. So now if you look at these two equations, are precisely Maxwell equations for the potential a equals to xi. OK, so solution to Maxwell equations equations with a equals psi a. So that's why any Killing vector in a vacuum spacetime will be a solution of Maxwell equations. And this was actually first, well, not really noticed by Wald, but he actually used this fact to study magnetic fields in Kerr spacetime and stuff like that, just basically for free. You know the symmetries, then hence you know some solutions of Maxwell equations, and these solutions actually may be important and interesting for physics, and so that's what people do. Let me just notice that actually if I don't have a vacuum, but I have, let's say, ADS, then you know that from that equation, you can actually show that the Ricci tensor is proportional to lambda times the metric. Okay, so if you are in ADS space, you are in vacuum plus lambda. Not necessarily ADS, vacuum plus lambda. So asymptotically ADS, let's say, I have Kerr ADS space time or whatever. So this is true. So then, if you plug it here, actually you see that this thing just becomes lambda times xi. Okay, And so you are basically satisfying an equation, nabla square plus lambda on xi equals to 0, and divergence of xi equals to 0 still. So this is actually a massive vector equation, right? So actually, the cosmological constant sort of induces the mass for the vector field. So this still is like massive vector equation still. Okay, so this trick can really be used nicely for some things. So that's first, and then we are running out of time. So let me just mention in 2 minutes, the second consequence is how many killing vectors we have. So how many at most killing vectors? And that's another consequence of this integrability condition. So I start at one point, and I'm asking, so I have at point P, I'm asking how many initial data I have to specify to say, you know, what possible killing vectors I have everywhere in the space. How many possible killing vectors? So of course, at the point, I have to specify what is my initial xi a. Okay, so I have to specify in n dimensions, I have to specify n data. Okay, so xi a provides n data. Then I also need to know what are the first derivatives of that vector at that point in order to find these things. So now, what is the first derivative of the metric of this thing here is let's call this LAB. So let's call LAB nabla A xi B. OK, so that's what describes the first derivatives of this killing vector. And from this killing equation, you see that this LAB plus LBA is 0. So LAB is antisymmetric. OK, so this is antisymmetric. The symmetric. So in n dimensions, it has n over 2 data to specify at that one point. And if I specify n over 2 data of these things, I will know everything about the first derivatives of the killing vector. Okay, then I proceed. Okay, so I need to specify. So this is the killing vector at point. This is the first derivative. So now 3 derivatives of the killing vector. Okay. However, so now we may say I need to specify more data. But if you look at this equation here, then this is my LBC. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead. 2 derivatives, of course. Sorry for that. I need to specify 2 derivatives of that thing. So 2 derivatives I see here, right? But due to this integrability condition, I see that the 2 derivatives of the killing vector actually is related to the Riemann, which is given in a given manifold, times the killing vector itself. I already specified these. Okay, and so this is something which is fixed for my manifold, so it doesn't represent anything. So actually, the second derivatives are already known. Okay, once I specify what this guy is, I already know these guys. So now you may think, well, 3 derivatives. Okay, so 3 derivatives. I differentiate once more here. I have 3 derivatives on the killing vector. Then I'll have derivative of the Riemann, which I know because I'm in fixed manifold, times this, and then plus another term, which is Riemann, times derivative of xi, which is L. I know it. Okay, so 3 derivatives, 3 derivatives of xi will be derivative of Riemann very schematically times xi plus Riemann times derivative of psi, which is L. Okay, I know this guy, I know that guy. So actually, I know three derivatives. And you can keep going. So because of that integrability condition, you can always reduce it on the knowledge of psi and L. So all the data you need to know, and all the data which are independent to know everything about Killing vectors, is how many psi's and how many L's. So the total number is simply n times n over 2. And that's how many at most Killing vectors you have. So by the way, of course, this will be true for our maximally symmetric spacetimes. And it can be shown that all maximally symmetric spacetimes is this number of Killing vectors are actually described locally by the construction I have shown. Okay, so really, this is why maximally symmetric. By the way, for real manifold, the number will be much smaller. But again, how you can actually do this is that we have this beautiful equation here. So I have three derivatives of psi. And I have this something I know, this something I can plug in, this something I know, and this something I know. So now the only thing which is unpleasant is this three derivatives on the left-hand side. But you can use the Riemann identity to get rid of nabla. And you can turn it into an algebraic equation. So for example, if you have two derivatives here, then I turn it into a Riemann times something. So if I anti-symmetrize. And so you can actually turn this equation into an algebraic equation. And that algebraic equation constrains what these psi's and L's are. And so for a given spacetime, given Riemann tensor, you can very quickly study these algebraic equations, show that they have that many solutions. And so you can really say how many Killing vectors in a given spacetime are just by solving some homogeneous equations. Anyway, so let me finish here. Questions? OK, sorry for going late.